Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Lee Liberman Otis, Senior Vice President of the Federalist Society and Director of our Faculty Division. On behalf of the Federalist Society, and specifically the Society's Faculty Division and Practice Groups, which are co-sponsoring this event, I'm delighted to welcome all of you here today to our first exclusively virtual preview of the upcoming Supreme Court term. Whether you're watching over Zoom, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, or via our webpage, we're delighted to have you with us. We are recording this, as is C-SPAN, so you may find yourself on C-SPAN at some point in the future. We don't know when. Before we turn to our discussion of the cases and other momentous aspects of the upcoming term, I want to say a few words about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died 2 weeks ago. I first met Justice Ginsburg 37 years ago when I was a law clerk on the DC Circuit and she was a judge there. Judges are randomly assigned to panels on the courts of appeals, and my boss, then Judge Scalia, was always delighted when they were on a panel together. Justice Ginsburg was an extraordinary woman, an extraordinary justice, an extraordinary lawyer, and an extraordinary American. I would like to ask for a brief moment of silence in her honor. Let me now introduce our moderator and then turn this over to him to introduce the rest of our panel and get our discussion underway. Robert Barnes got his bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Florida. He's been a Washington Post reporter and editor since 1987. He joined the paper to cover Maryland politics, and he has served in various editorial positions, including Metropolitan Editor and National Political Editor. He's covered the Supreme Court since November 2006. We very much appreciate his taking on the job of moderating this panel, despite many other demands on his time, given the unusual amount of Supreme Court news, even for this time of year. In light of this, we trust our speakers will give him an easier time moderating this panel than his fellow journalist, Chris Wallace, experienced a couple days ago. Over to you, Bob.
Well, thank you, Lee. On the contrary, we're going to follow the usual rules, which is interrupt each other, belittle each other. I'd like to see you, show your disagreement with eye rolls and face scrunches. We're going to move fairly quickly. And if I feel like one of you is taking too much time, I will gently nudge you along by saying something like, "Will you shut up, man?" Or lady, as it depends. It's a big term. They're all big terms, right, at the Supreme Court. Perhaps at this point, not as big as the one we had last year with so many controversial topics and, overtime. We didn't finish until mid-July. The docket so far this year is not as crammed, but, maybe they're leaving a little time for some unexpected cases that might arise after November 3rd. So to start with, we're going to go through, each of the panelists has a case that he or she is going to talk about, and then we're going to do another round after that. So first, let me just say that your panelists are, and this is going to be much shorter introductions, Orrin Kerr, who's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, Edmund Whalen, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Elizabeth Papez, partner at Gibson Dunn, Aaron Hawley, Independent Women's Law Center, and Alan Morrison, Associate Dean at the George Washington University Law School. I think that you have their full resumes, so you should look at them. And she's probably sick of hearing it, but Aaron's is the most interesting one. I'll just tell you that. So first, we are going to start with Aaron, and she is going to talk about one of the most notable cases on the term docket so far, and that is the Affordable Care Act case, California v. Texas.
Great. Thanks so much for that introduction and for having us all. And yes, I have the privilege of talking about the Affordable Care Act again. This is the third time, of course, that the entire statute has been before the Supreme Court. And of course, various provisions have been up and back from the court a number of times. So not the first time, to put it mildly, that the Supreme Court will take a look at the Affordable Care Act. And the centerpiece of this challenge, as in other challenges to this legislation, is again the individual mandate. So when we look at the Affordable Care Act, one of the more controversial provisions, was set forth in Section 5000A and 5000AB. And under those provisions, it required certain qualifying individuals to ensure that they had purchased qualifying insurance. And if they did not purchase qualifying insurance, then they had the responsibility to pay a penalty that was enforced by the IRS. Of course, we fast forward a few years to 2012, and we get the Supreme Court's decision in NFIB versus Sebelius. In this litigation, as most of you will recall, the focus of the litigation was really on the Commerce Clause. And the challengers to the litigation were making the argument that Congress has the power to regulate entities, to regulate items once they are in commerce. But on the other hand, they cannot force someone to, in Justice Scalia's words, buy broccoli or to enter that stream of commerce themselves, that, as I said, the Affordable Care Act did. In a sort of switch, the Supreme Court held that the penalty provision was actually a tax. At least for constitutional purposes, statutory purposes, AIA purposes, it was a penalty. But for constitutional purposes, the provision could be construed as a tax. So the Supreme Court upheld the provision under the broader power of Congress to lay and collect taxes. So now we fast forward to about 2017. And in this Congress, under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, signed by President Trump, Congress zeroed out that individual mandate penalty that has sort of been the basis for upholding the legislation in NFIB. So then we get a challenge from Texas and 18 other states. And in this challenge, Texas is alleging that the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate is now unconstitutional because the mandate's penalty is zero. And they argue that, a zero tax can't be any sort of tax at all. The case went to Judge O'Connor in Texas, a district court. Judge O'Connor struck down the individual mandate, agreeing with Texas and the other states. And he also struck down the entire statute. Judge O'Connor looked at NFIB and other cases and determined that the mandate was inseparable from the other provisions of the ACA, but he put that severability holding on pause, basically. He stayed his mandate. The Court of Appeals took up the case, the Fifth Circuit. They agreed with Judge O'Connor that the individual mandate can no longer be sustained under the taxing power. But this is sort of key for procedural steps going forward. They disagreed as to severability. So what the court did was they basically punted and they remanded back to the district court, told them to go back through the 900-page ACA to analyze it with a fine comb and to see again whether the provision might be severable from the ACA. So it's in this sort of unique posture that California and other states supporting the legislation file a petition for cert. And the Supreme Court somewhat surprisingly grants the petition because again, they could have let it go back on remand. The lower court could have considered severability again. And then the case could have come back up through the Fifth Circuit. And at that point, the court could have granted cert. But no, they granted cert. So the question before the court is whether, first, the individual mandate is constitutional, and second, there's the legal question, if it's not, then is the entire ACA destined to fall, or is the provision severable? So real quickly on the arguments made by the parties, California and the House of Representatives first argue that the states and individuals challenging it don't have standing. The District and Court of Appeals disagreed with this, finding that they were compelled to purchase insurance, and the state suffered harm from reporting and other sort of paperwork requirements from state employees. Then there's the question of the constitutionality of the individual mandate. This, I think, is super interesting, because if you look back, commentators from both sides of the aisle really sort of poo-pooed this claim from the outset. But if you look at the court's holding in NFIB, Chief Justice Roberts is very clear that the essential feature of a tax is that it raised some government revenue. So if you just look at NFIB, you've got a fairly strong argument to be made here that maybe a tax at zero isn't a tax at all. To me, the most interesting part of the case will be the question of severability. We get a few clues as to severability from last term. In the CELA law case, the Supreme Court narrowly applied the severability doctrine. They found the structure of the CFPB to be unconstitutional, but upheld the statute. And in doing so, Chief Justice Roberts used some interesting language. He said that the settled severability doctrine is to try to limit the solution to the problem, severing any problematic portions, unless there's strong evidence that Congress intended otherwise. So I think the real question here, at least in my opinion, is the question of severability. The states challenging the provisions say that you need to look to the 2010 findings of Congress, which found that the individual mandate was inextricably linked because it provided funding for the other provisions. On the other hand, the House of Representatives and the California and other states supporting the ACA argue that, actually what we should look at is the 2017 legislation. And in that case, Congress clearly contemplated the ACA without an enforceable mandate with a zero penalty. Interesting there to compare this to 2010 versus 2017 and what that means to severability. And I think I'm out of time.
Okay, thank you very much, Erin. Just a reminder to those listening in, we're going to have a Q&A session towards the end of this. We'll be taking questions from you to Erin, to any of the panelists, and about any of the cases or we've discussed or those that we don't discuss. So if you have questions about that, and I do, we will tackle those, I promise. Next up is Alan Morrison. He is going to be talking about Department of Justice v. House Committee on the Judiciary, or as we call it in the press room, the Mueller grand jury case.
So what could be more exciting than trying to get access to the grand jury materials Special Counsel Mueller presented there. There's a problem, of course, and that there's a general rule of secrecy under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure for materials going before the grand jury. I think most people agree that at some point that grand jury secrecy should be eliminated, that is after passage of time. And in a number of cases, some of which my old office was involved in, grand jury materials involving Alger Hess, the Rosenbergs, and even Richard Nixon's appearance before the Watergate grand jury, all those eventually became public under what was considered to be an implied exception to Rule 6E, that after some period of time for historically valuable materials, they should all be able to be turned over. And the Justice Department has disagreed with that for a long period of time, not so much as a matter of policy, but because they thought that Rule 6E did not admit of any kind of inherent exception to it. Then a couple of years ago, the DC Circuit, the first circuit court in some time to face that question, ruled in favor of the Justice Department, saying that there was no inherent right to access to grand jury materials, no matter how long they had been laying fallow. In the meantime, before the recent DC Circuit case, the Attorney General of the United States in the Obama administration had sent a letter to the Rules Committee saying, you know, we think that the law ought to be changed and there ought to be an historic exception for that, and perhaps other exceptions as well. The Rules Committee rejected that because they thought that it was not necessary to change the rules because all the cases had gone in favor of historic exceptions. That exception obviously no longer applies, and it's going to have to be fixed by the Rules Committee. This case is much narrower, however. This case involves an exception to the grand jury exception, under which a judicial proceeding, matters involved in a judicial proceeding, can be released. Typically, that arises in a case in which the defendant wants to cross-examine a witness who's appeared before the grand jury, and in those situations, obviously the defendant gets the right to the grand jury material to see whether it's inconsistent or not. This case involves the question as to whether an impeachment proceeding before the Congress constitutes a judicial proceeding and hence subject to that exception. The DC Circuit ruled that it did constitute a judicial proceeding, and that's the question before the court. Two other points I want to make about this case is, one is, it's not clear that this case is not going to become moot. The subpoena that was issued during the time that the impeachment proceeding was going on. And two things have to happen for the case not to be moot on January 20th. President Trump no longer has to be in office, or even if he's in office, the House has to decide whether it wants to renew the subpoena or not. These problems were obvious to the court when they agreed to take the case. So it's unclear whether they're anxious to take the case or not. But of course, they decided to take the case many, many months ago. I think I have a little bit of time left, so let me just talk about one other case that's before the court. It's called Carney against Adams, and it deals with the Delaware statutes that provide for two different ways of seeing that there is a balance on the several of the courts, the Delaware Supreme Court and a couple of others. And they have two rules. One is called the bare majority rule. It's not my name, it's what they call it on the opinions. And under that, if there are, for example, seven judges on a court, no more than four can be of the same political party. The second rule is that if there is a vacancy on the court, the constitutional provision in Delaware says that they must appoint someone from a political party that will not cause the bare majority rule to be violated. That has been interpreted to mean that only Democrats and Republicans can serve on the Supreme Court of Delaware. And it was that provision that the Third Circuit said was unconstitutional. When they decided that, because that provision was added to earlier provisions, they invoked the doctrine of severability that Aaron mentioned just a moment ago, and concluded that because they were all part of the same legislative package, that the provision for the bare majority would go by the way of the Democrat and Republican provision. And so they struck that down on severability grounds. The severability law in that situation seems to me to be the law of severability of Delaware, since it is Delaware's statute that we're trying to analyze, not the statute that the Congress had enacted. And in any event, the court has both of these issues before it. And it also has the question about what's the arguable justification. I joined an amicus brief that said that the notion of political appointees and policymaking had nothing to do with this, that there was a legitimate interest in seeing that there was balance. I don't think the court is going to reach that issue, but if it does, it may say something about balanced representation, not only on courts, but in administrative agencies running from the Federal Election Commission to the Federal Trade Commission to the Securities and Exchange Commission. So we'll keep an eye on that case as well.
Thanks, Alan. It's somewhat appropriate that the court kicks off its term with a question about political appointments to the Supreme Court, isn't it? Next up, Orrin Kerr, and he will be talking to us about a case called Van Buren v. U.S.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you to the Federal Society for inviting me here. The case I'm talking about, as mentioned, is Van Buren versus the United States, which is a criminal case involving a law called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. It's the federal computer hacking statute that was enacted in the 1980s. And although we've all moved to computers, as we are in this panel, the Supreme Court has never interpreted what this law means. And it matters to a lot of people because it basically is saying, how easy is it to commit a computer crime? And how many of us are computer criminals by virtue of this 1980s law enacted in a very different era? And so let me tell you the facts of the case and then turn to the legal issues. Van Buren is a police officer who has access to a government database of information about people. And he accepted a payment to look up someone that some private party was interested in knowing about. So he used the government database for non-official reasons. Even though he had been trained, you're only allowed to access the database for official reasons. It turned out that was all part of a government sting. The FBI had actually had the person who'd asked Van Buren to look up this individual for the payment. It was all part of a government sting. And Van Buren is then charged with violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act on the theory that he had been told he should only access the database for official reasons, and he had actually accessed the database for non-official reasons, and therefore he had violated the law. The law says that it's a federal crime to access a computer without authorization or to exceed authorized access to any protected computer. And under the statute, a protected computer is basically any computer. The definition of it is any computer that can be reached under the Commerce Clause, which, if you think about like Gonzalez versus Raich, means kind of any computer, really, whether connected to the internet or not. Everything is covered, or pretty close to everything is covered under this law. So the really big question becomes, what is access without authorization and exceeding authorized access? And in this case, it is agreed by the parties that the issue is whether Van Buren exceeded authorized access, because he had been given an account to access the database. And so he had initially accessed it with authorization, but did he exceed authorized access? Well, there's a statutory definition, which, of course, you turn to first. And here's what the definition is. The term exceeds authorized access means to access a computer with authorization and to use such access to obtain or alter information in the computer that the accessor is not entitled so to obtain or alter. Which, at least when I hear that, it's an entirely circular definition. It sort of just says you can't do what you can't do without actually answering what's the fundamental question of what you can't do. Why does this case matter? Well, the two sides have starkly different understandings of what the law means. The defense side, Van Buren side, says the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is just about computer hacking. It's about breaking in. And you're not breaking into a computer if you just violate some sort of a written restriction, or you were told not to do something and you did it anyway. That could be a contractual violation. It could be an employment problem, but it's not a federal crime. You're not hacking in. And so from the defense side, the defense argues this law should be construed to only apply to hacking, to breaking in, to circumventing some sort of a access restriction. The government's argument on the other side is that the law is intended to apply not only to somebody who hacks in, but also somebody who, upon gaining access, has violated some restriction, including some written restriction, and therefore that Van Buren violated this law because he was told not to access the computer for personal reasons, and he did so. Why does this case matter? Well, it matters because the law is written so broadly. This statute, Section 1030A2 in Title 18, is so broad that it applies to basically any computer and basically any written restriction, if it applies to written restrictions at all. So the Supreme Court has to decide, is this Computer Fraud and Abuse Act just about hacking, or does it apply to hacking and violating any written restriction on a computer? That matters to a lot of people, because if you've ever noticed, you're probably violating terms of service to a computer right now. And so it's very common for people to violate terms of service to a website, to an online social media site. You know, you have to tell the truth when you log into Facebook and give your real name. You're on a dating service, you have to give your real age. The government's theory lays out the possibility that if the government is right, actually all of those acts are federal crimes, and that the statute is basically criminalizing kind of everyone and everything, or at least that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but not much. So this is really going to be coming to the Supreme Court to figure out what does this law mean, and also answer how many people, as they use computers, are violating this criminal statute and potentially could be arrested and prosecuted. The court has an opportunity to either adopt a narrow interpretation of the statute just about hacking, or a broad interpretation. And I suspect either way it goes, it's ultimately going to come back to Congress to kind of come up with answers depending on what the Supreme Court's interpretation is.
Thanks. Orrin, let me play editor for a second. Do you know if this is the only thing he was charged with, this officer?
He was charged with another offense. He was also in charge with wire fraud, if I recall correctly, or another fraud offense. Basically, I think it was like an honest services fraud idea.
He was being bribed.
He was being bribed. Exactly. So there's the bribe, and then there's the computer hacking offense. And so that remaining bribery related charge is still there on remand after the court decides this either way.
Okay. Thank you. Elizabeth is going to talk about a case involving Ford Motor Company and also a little bit about the business docket.
Thanks, Bob and Lee and the Society. It's great to be here and with all of you, albeit in the Brady Bunch format. I will I'll get to the Ford cases. I mean, I appreciate the moment on Justice Ginsburg. She was a lion in so many ways. And actually, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about the Ford Motor cases is it's an area in the court in which she's left quite a legacy. Across lines on the court, some supermajority opinions. I think it'll be a great segue to discuss what's on everyone's mind these days, which is her legacy as against the current vacancy. And I think we can have some fun talking about that on the business docket, which has some great cases and also a little bit of the constitutional flavor that Aaron previewed in the Affordable Care Act case. The business docket, we're only about a third of the way into the grants in the term. We don't have the orders from the long conference, but already, we've got some big ticket cases. We've got the cases in the Ford matter I'll address in a moment about where companies can be sued in federal court. We've got cases about where a company, a domestic U.S. company, can be held liable for human rights abuses abroad, what constitutes fair use of a rival's intellectual property, when you can enforce your arbitration clause, and then, when and whether companies can be subjected to, frankly, massive liability under the FTC Act, also under the robocall statute. And then we've got this Fannie and Freddie case I'll touch on at the last. That's where we're going to see what the court is going to do with these runaway agencies that are unconstitutionally structured and out there regulating people. It goes to the severance point. On the Ford cases, I'll just spend a moment because they're so important. You see this in the amicus lineup. It's not just the auto industry, it's pharma, it's banking, it's consumers and big tech. The issue is, where can a company that makes a product or delivers a service be sued by a person who's hurt as a result of using that product? The Ford cases, it's a simple fact pattern. They're two companion cases. Individuals who were driving Ford cars. One was injured, regrettably. It was a fatal accident when a tire blew out. And the other was an instance where an airbag didn't deploy. So the bottom line is, in one case, the estate, in the other case, the injured plaintiff sued Ford Motor for defective parts, the tires and the airbags. The issue in both cases is whether these plaintiffs were entitled to sue the company in the state in which they were injured. And the reason we care about this, especially here at the Society, but also as citizens, is our Constitution says that federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction, and they can't exercise their power over a person or a defendant without due process. And the Supreme Court has long held that for a lawsuit to satisfy due process, one of two things has to be true. The defendant has to be at home in the state or the forum in which they're being sued. Because if you live there, you've consented to being sued there on anything that arises in the jurisdiction. These cases involve the second branch of jurisdiction doctrine, which is called specific jurisdiction. In that instance, the Supreme Court has said it's okay for a plaintiff to sue a defendant in federal court in a diversity case like this, if, but only if, the defendant's outreach or contacts with that forum relate directly to the suit or the injury at issue. This is a really important point. And what happened in both of these cases that are before the court now is state Supreme Court said, although it's uncontested that in both plaintiffs' cases, they didn't buy their car from Ford directly where they were injured, the cars ended up there as a result of a bunch of private resales. The cars were manufactured in a different state. They were sold initially at retail in a different state. The mere fact that Ford does a lot of business in each of the states, in Montana and Minnesota, is enough to subject the company to suit, even though it had no direct causal relationship with these plaintiffs driving these cars or the injuries that occurred. That actually goes against a long line of, again, supermajority Supreme Court cases on the general jurisdiction side. Justice Ginsburg authored an opinion in 2014 in the Daimler case that said general jurisdiction, namely exercising jurisdiction just because somebody's present there and you don't connect the suit to the defendant's conduct, is permissible only in the defendant's principal place of business or headquarters or home state. Narrow the doctrine. On the specific jurisdiction side, the court has also long held in a series of 9-0 and 8-1 decisions that you've got to have a tight nexus between what the defendant did, its outreach to that forum, and what happened to the particular plaintiff. That does not appear to exist in either of these cases, which may explain the grant. I don't think this is one of those cases where, you know, whether Judge Barrett is confirmed or not, you know, that confirmation would affect the vote. Again, there's a long line of precedent, 9-0s and 8-1s, to say that this kind of nexus is not enough. And the reason is simple. If it were, then anybody who puts anything into the stream of commerce in any state can be sued there, and we might as well do away with the limits on general jurisdiction. So I think we'll see that in sharp contrast, I think, to that case and how the court has lined up on those issues kind of across lines. There's some other business cases, and we'll touch on maybe the Fannie and Freddie case, which is very interesting, where I think, you know, the confirmation and the vacancy may actually implicate the court's lineup.
Great, thank you. I've never moderated a panel in which lawyers have so abided by their time limits. I'm a little shocked by this. We may be wrapping it up in no time at all. Ed is gonna take our next case, which in many ways is a follow-up to the issues that the court didn't get to in Masterpiece Cake Shop. And it is sort of the intersection of laws against discrimination and when they bump up against religious liberty. So Ed will be talking about a case called Fulton v. City of Philadelphia.
Thank you very much, Bob. The case of Fulton versus City of Philadelphia will be argued on November 4th, the day after Election Day. The issue in the case is whether a Catholic group can be barred from providing foster care services in Philadelphia because it abides by Catholic beliefs on marriage and approving families eligible to receive foster kids. As Bob indicated, the case is another in the series presenting the clash between religious liberty and LGBT non-discrimination norms. It presents at one level how Employment Division versus Smith might apply to the particular fact pattern involved in the case. It also, more importantly, tees up Employment Division versus Smith for possible overruling. That's one of the questions on which the court expressly granted review. Now, as I think many of you know, Employment Division versus Smith is the 1990 opinion of the Supreme Court in which a 5-justice majority, part of a 6-justice majority on the holding, but a 5-justice majority on the rationale, ruled that neutral and generally applicable laws that burden religious liberty nonetheless present no free exercise claim. That ruling is probably the most controversial ruling by Justice Scalia among conservatives, at least. It was seen as overruling a line of cases that applied strict scrutiny to substantial burdens on religious liberty. Congress responded very rapidly in 1993 with the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which reimposed the strict scrutiny standard that preceded Smith. Then, 4 years later, in the City of Bernie v. Flores case, the Supreme Court said that the federal RFRA could not constitutionally be applied against the states. So the RFRA continues to apply against federal actors, but under Bernie versus Flores, it does not apply against state actors. And that's why you had a flurry of so-called mini RFRAs, state religious freedom restoration acts, adopted in the states. And what we've seen in recent years is that the unanimous consensus in favor of the federal RFRA in 1993 has now come apart as the ideological valence of religious liberty has shifted in the eyes of many. Very briefly, in this case, the Catholic entity, Catholic Social Services, known as CSS, makes a slew of arguments under Smith, saying that the city's actions reflect hostility to its religious beliefs, that the city has a system of individualized exemptions that takes the case out of Smith, that the city itself doesn't abide by the non-discrimination norms that it's trying to hold CSS to. And in turn, in the Supreme Court, the city has advanced a new argument that CSS is merely, quote, performing government services and exercising delegated government power, end quote, and has minimal free exercise rights in doing so. Now, I think that strikes me as a sweeping assertion of statism. We'll see how the court addresses it. The Catholic Church has been doing foster care work in Philadelphia from long before the city got involved. If the city can successfully contend that it's now simply performing government services, that raises the question of what limits, if any, are there to a government entity's ability to make similar claims in other areas, whether it's marriage licensing, educating kids, or so on. So there are various grounds on which the case could be decided one way or the other without revisiting Smith. It's also conceivable that the court will see this case as the occasion to revisit Smith. There are several justices who have already expressed their hostility to Smith. We've also seen in recent cases an ability to carve matters out of the scope of Smith, whether implicitly or explicitly. So I'll try to stay within Bob's time limits and leave it right there.
All right, thank you, Ed.
Could I ask Ed a small fact question?
You may.
Ed, I had heard someplace that the Catholic party in this case has never had a request from same-sex couples to adopt a child. Is that factually correct, and might that matter in terms of their standing in this case?
I understand that to be factually correct. I don't think it affects standing in any way. There are dozens of child placing agencies from which prospective foster parents can request a home study. That's a prerequisite to getting approved, and including three that have received the Human Rights Campaign's seal of approval. So the CSS says that no same-sex couple has ever asked it for home study, and if it did, the CSS would refer the couple to another agency, one that would be open to approving it for the home study. But no, I don't see how that bears on standing.
Of course, it could be a reason for the court to duck the case if it wanted to. It doesn't take any rule of law to duck a case that's dismissed as improvidently granted.
Well, except, of course, what's happened here is the agency has been disqualified by the city from further participation. So that would not, I mean, that'd be a ratifying the defeat for the agencies. I don't see that as an option.
The question is about their contract with the city, right?
There's a whole dispute back and forth over what course of action exactly is relevant. The city changed its contracts at one point to add specific broader language that it thinks strengthens its position. There's a question of whether there's a course of action before that reflects religious hostility. I can't do justice to the back and forth between the parties on some of these factual assertions.
So we've talked about some very specific cases. I'd like now to ask you to think about what Justice Ginsburg's death means, what Judge Barrett's confirmation might mean, and give me the sort of bigger view of what you see this court term being like under these circumstances. And Alan, let's start with you.
I think the answer is uncertain. I'm assuming that unless something turns up and people change their mind, that Judge Barrett will become Justice Barrett at some point. And how many cases she'll sit on is hard to know, depending on what happens. I just would want to say, with regard to what Elizabeth said about the Ford cases, those cases are quite different from all the cases that have come before the court. And while I've written that Justice Ginsburg was surely right in the outcome of the prior cases when it was the plaintiffs that were engaging in very aggressive forum shopping. I disagreed strongly with her rationales and the breadth of her opinions. This is a case about forum shopping, the Ford case, in which it's not at all clear, given Justice Ginsburg's vote in the McIntyre case, that she would have gone along with this. The Ford Motor Company is saying, yes, we sell thousands of cars, we have service centers and all sorts of things like that in every state in the country. But you, the plaintiff, happen to not be the original buyer of that car in this state, and therefore you have to sue us either in Michigan, Delaware, or where the car was manufactured or designed, if you can figure that out. That seems to me like forum shopping. And I think the message from these other cases is broad forum shopping is out, and we'll see whether it applies to the same to the plaintiffs and to the defendants. But overall, I would agree with what Bob said at the beginning, that the court's docket is not really filled out first or as rich as it's been in prior years. On the other hand, all the cases that really came to the top at the end of the term were cases that were granted well after September or October. So it's very hard to know now. Obviously, Justice Barrett will not vote the same way as Justice Ginsburg did on many cases. But my view has always been that you don't really know what a judge is going to be like when she or he gets to the Supreme Court until they've been there a while. Justice Scalia was, in my view, much more moderate when he was on the Court of Appeals, not because he was hiding anything, but because the docket was different and his position in the judiciary was different. So it's hard to tell. Judge Barrett is a extremely able lawyer. And so you just never know when you get cases and you're in the Supreme Court, you see things quite a bit differently. And so while I'm not hoping that she's going to be a substitute for Justice Ginsburg, I'm not willing to write her off either.
Aaron, one of the things that has sort of been immediately mentioned is that one of the five members who upheld the Affordable Care Act is obviously gone now. Justice Judge Barrett has been critical of the ACA. But, you know, I go to listen in on a number of these Supreme Court previews, and I'm struck by how many people, lawyers who aren't fans of the ACA, who don't think that this case at the Supreme Court is a 5-4 one, as you said, that it might have much more to do with the question of severability as to whether the ACA survives. Could you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. And first I wanted to mention just a sort of wrinkle on timing. As Alan mentioned, we don't know when assuming Judge Barrett is confirmed to replace Justice Ginsburg, we don't know when that will occur. If it does take place before November 10th, which is when the court will hear Texas versus California, then of course she'll sit for that case. The tradition is that if the judge is not confirmed when oral argument is heard, then they don't participate. So Judge Kavanaugh, for example, recused himself from cases in which oral argument had already been heard. Same for Justice Kagan. So pretty safe assumption that Justice Barrett will vote on the cases only after her confirmation, assuming that happens. So if the case is 4-4, I think that's unlikely for reasons I'll mention. But if it is 4-4, the only thing that happens is that the Fifth Circuit's opinion on the individual mandate is upheld. Because they remanded on the severability issue, that remand will still take effect. So it'll go back to the Fifth Circuit, and then it'll go back to the district court to consider severability. So there won't be any decision if it's 4-4 in regard to the entire statute. Which I think is interesting. And then also, as you mentioned, I think that there's becoming a greater consensus as this case winds its way through the courts that the constitutional question may not actually be that close. You do have a Congress in 2017 that zeroed out the tax penalty. The Supreme Court and NFIB, at least in my opinion, sort of stretched things in order to call it a tax. But they were very clear, the chief was very clear, that in order to be a tax, the essential feature was that it must raise some revenue. And if we're talking about a broad power, that would certainly be the taxing power with no requirement that there be any sort of revenue raising. The government does all sorts of things through the taxing power, but the sort of check on that is that the government is accountable and that the public generally doesn't like taxes. And so the people will call the elected representatives to it'll count. But if taxes loses the meaning of being a tax, then that check on the power is absent. So I can see the Chief Justice finding that problematic under the new 2017 statute. But I think you're exactly correct. The question really does boil down to severability. The Fifth Circuit punted on this. But if you look at what Congress did in 2017, I think there's a really good argument to be made under the Supreme Court's old and present cases that the rest of the mandate is severable. And the reason for this is if you look at the 2017 Congress, they obviously thought an unenforceable mandate was compatible with the rest of the ACA. We're not talking about the situation in 2010 where they were counting on the revenue from that mandate to sort of prop up pre-existing coverage and that sort of thing. They tossed all that out the window with 2017. So you've got a Congress that clearly thinks an unenforceable mandate is compatible with the ACA. And I can see a court, especially one that may be reluctant or certain members may be reluctant to step into a huge political fight to find severability and interest.
Incumbent is not reelected and the Senate goes to the Democrats, Congress could pass a statute amending the ACA to provide a tax of $100 a year or some number like that, which would clearly raise some revenue. And that would at least moot the controversy and get the Supreme Court out of a tough situation. It certainly would be a sensible way for the Democrats to do that, assuming they have the power to do that. Aaron, do you think that would work in terms of mooting the controversy or at least giving the court a reason to send it back to the lower courts?
It certainly would give them reason to send it back because you'd have a different constitutional analysis. And the shared responsibility payments in the first statute were not necessarily large. So the court could find $100 to be sufficient. But I think as a constitutional matter, they would at least have to find that yes, Congress is imposing a tax. They're charging at least $100 if you violate it rather than an unenforceable mandate.
Well, just so long as we can find some way to keep ACA litigation going, you know, that's what everyone wants, I think. Oren, what do you think about what do you foresee about the term in these unusual circumstances that the court's facing?
Well, I wanted to go back to the question, even the broader one, Bob, that you were suggesting about, you know, where does the Supreme Court go with assuming Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed and becomes Justice Barrett? And I would guess that on the whole, we're going to see a considerable and perhaps quite rapid shift to the right. And I think it's sort of almost hard to remember that, you know, the Supreme Court can, in fact, change direction. And we almost lose sight of the fact that that's common in Supreme Court history. And we don't see that because we've had a history that's kind of remarkable of the last, you know, say, 40 years or 50 years where we had Justice Powell, the kind of moderate Republican as the center swing vote. And then it became Justice O'Connor as the kind of moderate center swing vote. And then Justice Kennedy as the sort of moderate center swing vote. And then we had Chief Justice Roberts as the swing vote. And, you know, would have been sensible to say, well, then things will shift. Although I think in light of Trump being president, I think Chief Justice Roberts, to try to ensure some sort of stability at the Supreme Court, to have the court be kind of the one institution in American life, which is not doing, you know, wacky things. I think he basically sort of remade himself as the moderate centrist Republican appointee swing vote. And the court didn't change very much. If you have Justice Barrett on the court, suddenly Chief Justice Roberts, who I think is sort of fundamentally a conservative and was being, you know, more institutional maybe than it would be his natural state, he's not even a swing vote anymore. He has the assignment power, but the swing vote on the court becomes, I guess, Brett Kavanaugh maybe, or Neil Gorsuch maybe, depending on the case. And a Supreme Court with Brett Kavanaugh or Neil Gorsuch as the swing vote, as sort of the fifth vote needed to make a majority. That's a very conservative court. And so I think we're looking at some considerable shifts. Maybe it'll take a term. Maybe they'll slow down at first because they've got the cert grants from prior terms. But I think the history, at least to me, suggests that when you have a majority that has a very clear kind of ideological direction, the court generally goes in that direction. This is, I think, the lesson of the Warren Court after Felix Frankfurter steps down. The court just didn't kind of sit around and have, you know, just sort of sit on, you know, just wait. They moved. And so I would at least guess that we're going to see some significant movements in a way that we haven't seen before, at least in a long time.
Ed, are you rubbing your hands in anticipation?
Well, I agree with much of what Orrin just said. That is, I think that the chief, having been lauded for occupying the median position on the court this last term, will no longer be there. Of course, as Orrin pointed out, he may have been to the left in that median position because of a response to President Trump. So it might well be that even apart from a new justice, he would have swung back right. If that is Joe Biden is elected. I think the chief will have the challenge of either, building some middle coalition with either Justice Kavanaugh or Justice Gorsuch, or being on the losing end of some cases, or making it a six-justice majority. The one point I'd emphasize, though, that I think counsels against a notion of sort of rapid shifts across the board is that, contrary to reports of her position on stare decisis, Judge Barrett very much adheres to a traditional view of stare decisis and has emphasized that it's perfectly fine for the Supreme Court to accept as an operating presumption that precedents have been rightly decided until such time as it's necessary to revisit them. So, and she's emphasized that the court doesn't have to go seeking out cases to overrule. So I don't think, the court will be very different if she replaces Justice Ginsburg. I don't think you're going to see an immediate search and destroy mission on a lot of precedents.
Well, I mean, this is a court that doesn't seem that reluctant to overturn precedent, except for Justice Kagan, who talks about it a lot. Elizabeth, what do you see when you think about the term that's coming up?
Yeah, I mean, I view it in two pieces, right? I think certainly in the business docket, which is where I, practice most, as I said at the outset, I don't think there's going to be any major shift. I think in part because a lot of those cases are decided on the terms of very specific statutes and in line with the court's own precedents in ways where there are already the votes, for a particular result. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of play in the joints there. You know, to Alan's point on the, even on the jurisdictional cases, I mean, I agree that new composition might affect the breadth or the rationale of some of the rulings, like in the Ford cases. We could spend an hour on them. There are some differences, but I think at bottom, if these state Supreme Courts are correct, they've elided the distinction between general and specific jurisdiction in a way that's very difficult to reconcile, with Justice Ginsburg's Daimler opinion, and that's a fact. Where I think, you'll see, to get to a finer point, and you see this in the briefing, interestingly, is that Ford and its amici are urging a proximate cause standard where you have to have a really tight nexus between, the defendant's contact with the state and the suit. Solicitor General's office, interestingly, has not taken that position, and they were not granted separate argument time for their more moderate view on that. Back in the Bristol-Myers case 3 years ago, the Solicitor General's office, as I recall, did urge a proximate cause standard. So that's where, it's at that level of granularity and in writing these opinions that I could see some differences. I will tell you, I think the area where we could see differences, and it goes to, the severability point that Aaron mentioned, we're going to see it this term in the Fannie-Freddie case. We saw it last term in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau case, Saylor Law. Is what to do about an unconstitutional agency that's taken action against someone. And then, one option is, well, if they were unconstitutional because the statute that made them had some problematic provision, right? And this term in the Fannie Freddie case, it's the same as last term with the CFPB. There's a provision that says the person at the agency making the decisions and enforcing federal law is not adequately supervised by the president, so they're not politically accountable. It's a constitutional problem. We're supposed to have people exercising the law who are accountable to our elected officials. That's bedrock. The issue is what to do about it. If you take out that provision and you leave the agency to operate, that may be fine on a prospective basis. I think the hard question arises, and where the composition of the court could really matter, is what to do about the violation that occurred when the constitutional defect was present. You may recall, you know, the court confronted some National Labor Relations Board decisions in the Noel Canning case, the SEC administrative law judges. You know, the court was trending in a direction of constitutional violations need to mean something. And if they were, if a constitutional violation resulted in a decision that actually hurt or affected someone, there may be a serious problem with just saying, well, let's take out the bad provision of the statute, rubber stamp the unconstitutional decision, and roll along. That's frankly, you know, the court was on the bubble on that. There was a lot of vote splitting in the Saylor Law opinion last term. This is where I think, you know, the composition of the court could matter, that Judge Barrett may, you know, be stronger on some of these remedial issues, frankly, than we saw in the Saylor split last term.
Yeah, I would wonder, Elizabeth, too, if she might consider that this it's a structural violation, right? So whether that might matter. Do you think a constitutional structural violation might make a difference?
I think so, just from the standpoint that, you know, doctrinally, if it's a structural problem, the act that the government agency took, you know, is void ab initio, right? It was never authorized. And you've got some precedent for this in the appointments clause, you know, not to get too nerdy on this, but, you know, the current cases are about removal. We have cases that are just on the front end, right? If some officer of the United States was not constitutionally appointed, then everything that person did was void. Some people, I think, try to draw the distinction. I don't know that you would, between saying, well, once you're appointed, if you're not politically, you know, accountable, everything you do is still void. Because once you're appointed and you're in office, the only thing that renders you accountable to the people and disciplines you is the threat of removal by an elected official. So I do think the structural nature of some of these violations will matter. And I think, what, you know, where the rubber's going to meet the road, and it's going to have a big practical consequence. You see this all over the country right now. There are tons of cases that are grappling with the issue the court, you know, left for remand in Saylor Law on June 26th, which is you can sever this bad provision that made the CFPB unconstitutional until the court took the provision away. What happens to those decisions, enforcement decisions, going forward? Can the agency just stamp them and keep rolling? Or do they have to start over from square one and make sure that they have the jurisdictional and limitations and all the other boxes checked to keep going? So that it's going to be, I think, a big deal, and it could really be consequential with the new composition of the court.
There's a case on the pending docket, which could be announced anytime. It's actually several cases coming from the Federal Circuit involving the appointment of administrative patent judges. Yeah. And there's a question of whether they're inferior officers or principal officers. And this issue about retroactivity, if you call it that, some of the parties didn't object at the administrative level. Some of them objected at the court level. But unlike the CFPB, where there's only one administrator who's doing something, there are, I think, 360 patent judges whose decisions regularly get appealed to the Federal Circuit. And quite apart from the quite difficult and interesting question on the merits of whether they're inferior officers or not, this remedial issue is going to be huge in terms of practicalities. And I think Elizabeth's firm has got at least one of those cases. And those of us who are interested in the administrative law side are puzzling about what to do about it. I don't think we care about who's, as between two patentees, who's winning and who's not. But we are concerned about how this is going to impact not just the patent judges, but the judges at all the rest of the administrative agencies, and perhaps other judges at places like Social Security or the immigration judges. So it's a huge issue that the court is going to have to face. And whoever the replacement is for Justice Ginsburg, or whenever that comes about, that case will certainly be heard by a full nine justices, and a good thing it will be to have them all of them on the court. But that's a really significant case across the business community. That is, people can be on both sides. Indeed, I imagine there's probably some companies that are on both sides of the issue coming up from the federal circuit.
Let me ask you, there was a case from Wisconsin in the spring about voting. It was called Republican National Committee versus Democratic National Committee. The court split 5-4 on it. It seems like the kind of case that the court really hates to weigh in on, but not a day, certainly not a week goes by. Lately, it's been not a day goes by that I don't see another emergency application get to the court about some voting change. So could you talk a little bit about how these voting issue, these cases about how people vote, how the ballots are going to be counted, affect the court leading up to the election, and then just speculate on what's going to happen after the election, since the president seemed to indicate fairly strongly the other night that he expected, the court maybe will decide this. Who'd like to go first? Do I have to pick someone? Orrin.
I was hoping you wouldn't pick me because I'm not well situated to answer these questions. Although after the mess that was Bush versus Gore, I just hope the Supreme Court stays as far away from these cases as possible.
Can they?
I mean, I think it largely depends on what lower courts do. But I think it makes a big difference in terms of the justices' attitude should the Supreme Court be the institution that answers these questions. And at least that what we know of what happened following the election of 2000, the justices, at least there was a majority that were thought we need to be the ones that resolve this. And that did not put the justices in their finest hour, to put it mildly. So hopefully other institutions can take this and it won't come up to a Supreme Court, especially in light of statements from President Trump that he wants to have Judge Barrett on the court to be a key vote for him in the prospect that there's election litigation. Just it's not going to be a happy situation if we get there, and I hope we don't.
Ed, what do you think? And has the president put Judge Barrett in a place where she'll be asked to recuse, and should she?
Well, folks are already asking. I'm not sure that the president's actual remarks were exactly as Orrin just depicted them, but I will take a look, and perhaps I'm mistaken. Look, recusal is a decision that's made, is heavily fact-dependent and made in a particular context. Have in mind, back in 2016, Ruth Bader Ginsburg made lots of remarks, very derogatory of Donald Trump. No one was suggesting at that time that if there were election litigation, she would have to recuse. And in fact, her derogatory remarks had a lot to do with his failure to disclose his taxes. Yet she did not see fit to recuse from the two big cases that presented the very question whether entities could seek to obtain his financial records this last year. I share Orrin's desire that there not be issues like this. I think it's quite possible that if there are, it may well be that there'd be a supermajority ruling against some challenges in a way that could have some long-term benefits for the court. My read, though, Bob, you follow this more closely than I have, so correct me if I'm wrong, is that in the election-related challenges so far, the court has largely had the rule that the existing state rules stay in effect, that lower federal courts should not be changing those. Now, what happens with some of the cases that involve state courts changing those, it gets a little more complicated. But I think the court is going to abide by a principle that the rules that are the state has enacted legislatively are the rules that, that ought to govern. That doesn't mean there won't be disputes, but it at least provides a for a baseline for deciding those.
Aaron, this would be one that your old boss, I'm sure, would not be that happy to see come to the court, his worry about the institutional reputation of the court. Do you think the other justices share that? Is he the one man band there?
Question. I think probably no. I think he may be the most cautious about wading into sort of political battles of the current justices. And as you mentioned earlier, sees the court as an institution and has an institutional prerogative at many times. But I would think that the entire court would be skeptical. There's, of course, the whole political question doctrine that comes up a lot in the election context and whether judges are capable of rendering judicially manageable standards. So from time immemorial, judges have been cautious about weighing into intensely political matters. So I think that would be shared across the court, but you're certainly correct that it would be a particular concern of Chief Justice Roberts.
Mm-hmm. I just want to tell those listening in, we do want to take your questions. There is the raise your hand symbol that will start taking questions on. Some other questions will be coming in other ways. And so please give this panel some questions. They'd like to take them. Elizabeth, is there another case? Is there anything else from that's coming up in the term that you think that we should talk about?
I guess, there's lots of things. The question is, from which perspective? I think there's some very interesting statutory interpretation cases coming up. One of them is, I think particular consequence. These are the FTC cases, AMG, and a companion case out of the Seventh Circuit. Literally just yesterday, the Seventh Circuit was out there on its own, splitting with all the other circuits on the question the Supreme Court's going to take up until yesterday when it got a companion in the Third Circuit. And the question is whether the Federal Trade Commission in enforcement actions can subject regulated industries or companies to a broad range of equitable remedies that the agency has deemed to include literally billion-dollar monetary penalties or disgorgement on the rationale that if, for example, a business engaged in some conduct that deceived a consumer, every penny that the business earned, from that act or practice or product should be disgorged. It's a tremendous hammer for the government in these cases. And what's up before the court is for a long time, and I think this is a kind of a trend that would continue if Judge Barrett is confirmed, that the justices have been much more careful about looking at the language of statutes. Last term in an SEC case, a case called Liu, the Supreme Court upheld the SEC's authority to impose those kinds of remedies because the SEC statute said in black and white that the agency had the power to issue injunctions, which is conduct restraint, as well as traditional forms of equitable relief, which, if you go back in history, included money. The FTC statute has no such words. Actually, it says the agency can grant injunctions, period, not other orders, not other equitable relief. And so I think in that case, and in many others I could cite, we're going to see the court confronting very consequential cases that are going to turn on the language of a particular statute. And one of the things that, sort of encouraged me when I was looking at some of Judge Barrett's opinions from the Seventh Circuit is she's been excruciatingly attentive to statutory language. She had a case where it was a trade secrets case, and she's done the same thing on jurisdiction, but in the trade secrets case, she focused very specifically on what the language was and then distinguished it from the language and the focus of trademark and patent cases. And so I thought, this is exactly the kind of careful jurisprudence and attention to statutory detail that is so important at the Supreme Court level. We have many cases coming up, and I think that approach is exactly right, because that's what the justices should be doing, looking at the language of the law.
Alan, is there anything from your perspective that you either are looking forward to the court doing or hoping the court won't do? Or
I think there's one issue on which the court is unanimous, and that is that the election not be close.
I think that that's right.
I would say to the extent that one tries to read tea leaves into what the court has done in these various election cases in the last year or so, it's very hard to do because most of them have no opinions in them and not extensive briefing. But to the extent you can see anything, it looks as though they're in favor of, I think maybe Ed said this, of stability, that is to not interrupt things in the middle. On the other hand, we have the coronavirus is different. It's not something that anyone could reasonably have anticipated before. And that at least where a state legislature or perhaps a duly authorized agent has authority to make changes to take into account current circumstances, I think the court will be more likely to sustain those, regardless of what the lower court say. But when people are trying to get the court to make changes, I think this court is not going to be willing to do that in the middle of the election. May I say one other word about the question about Judge Barrett's possible recusal, assuming that she is on board. As some of you may remember, in 1974, when the Nixon case was tapes case was before the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist recused himself in that case. There was no reason given for him doing that, and I think that that may be a question about whether he did it because of his closeness to Richard Nixon or for some other reason, including the fact that he had been criticized a couple of years before for not recusing himself in a case called Laird against Tatum. I don't think the president has done his nominee any favors by saying that he wants her there at time to decide, help decide the election, and is pushing for her confirmation before the election. But she, as Ed pointed out, will have to decide for herself. I'm sure that the senators are going to ask some questions about it. And of course, she shouldn't be pinned down on how she's going to decide cases, but whether they will view whether you're going to sit on this case differently as a matter of what senatorial views on the outcome.
I know that we have some participant questions. I am having trouble seeing them. So I'm just going to ask the tech support folks to help me out on that and to unmute someone who has a question. I think Ben Sellers is first.
While we're waiting, if I may, I just checked the transcript of the debate the other night. And Chris Wallace asked, are you counting on the Supreme Court, including a Justice Barrett, to settle any dispute? Trump said, yeah, I think I'm counting on them to look at the ballots, definitely, as though they're going to be examining the ballots one by one. In any event, I think it was a general statement that he expects the court to handle disputes. I don't think it was anything, that statement at least, anything that creates a special problem for Judge Barrett.
I suppose that's up to who's listening and what else has come before it. We shouldn't construe it like a statute, however. We can.
Ben Sellers, are you there? I don't hear him.
I think he's gone.
Who's next? Paul Breivik, are you there?
yes. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to put this on. Earlier this year, it made the news that the court denied certiorari in a number of Second Amendment cases, and I know they haven't addressed that in some years, but assuming Judge Barrett is confirmed, do you foresee any substantial change in the court's attitude toward Second Amendment petitions? Thank you.
Who'd like to take that?
I'm happy to address that. I do think that whether on the Second Amendment or other issues, the fact that the court has been inclined to deny review in a number of cases is something that will probably change if we have a Justice Barrett. It's much easier to get four votes for a conservative review of an opinion below when you have, you know, at least five justices to choose from. So, of course, Justice Barrett has written a significant dissent on a Second Amendment issue that's gotten some attention. And I think she would be very open to trying to provide the lower courts greater guidance than they have on these Second Amendment issues.
In fact, I think she listed that as her most significant decision in the Senate questionnaire that she just filled out. It has been a surprise to those of us who cover the court that the court has not taken up more of the Second Amendment issues, especially this term after Justice Kavanaugh in agreeing that they shouldn't decide the New York case that was theirs, called upon more. Does anyone have a theory as to why they didn't take any of those cases?
Well, I've heard the theory banded around is the Chief Justice was, the conservatives, the supporters of the Second Amendment were concerned that the Chief Justice might not be on board and they didn't want to take these cases unless they had a fifth vote. By the way, I am a believer that the Second Amendment has been overused and is being overused, but I actually agree with Judge Barrett's dissent in the case in which she basically said the person was charged with convicted of fraud and was denied the right to have a gun. And Judge Barrett said, I think correctly, that the old cases about felons not having the right to have a gun dealt with people who are dangerous, and people who commit fraud may be dangerous for other reasons, but having nothing to do with the guns. I remember when the Justice Scalia's decision in Heller, a case in which I participated on behalf of the district, made no exception in his opinion, said felons can be denied guns. And I thought that was probably wrong, that Scooter Libby and Martha Stewart should not be denied guns because they were convicted of felonies. But that's, I think, a relatively easy Second Amendment case. The much harder ones that are going to come up are the question about the concealed carry and the right to carry out in public. And the court may take those cases that it's turned down before.
We have a question from John Adler.
Hello. So I was curious what folks thought about both prospective Justice Barrett's influence on standing doctrine, and in particular, whether any of the folks on the panel think that the Chief Justice might like to use a case like California versus Texas to curtail Article III standing generally, and perhaps curtail the doctrine of special solicitude for state standing. That's something that the Chief Justice clearly was not happy with in Massachusetts versus EPA, and it seems a case in which the basis for standing is a provision of federal law that has no enforcement mechanism might well be a good opportunity to do something like that.
Who would like to take a standing question? Reporters do not take standing questions. Warren, I'm calling on you.
I would ask Jonathan Adler, who was just calling. You know, he'd be a great person to talk about this. I mean, I think that's certainly a possibility. I should also add, I share that sense that the idea of giving this sort of state standing in some of these cases is a stretch and could be cut back. So I think it's certainly possible, although I don't know specifically Judge Barrett's views and how that would fit in.
Aaron, do you have some views on this?
With regard, at least to individual standing, I'm not sure that California versus Texas is the case to pare that back, precisely because an unenforceable mandate seems problematic under the taxing clause. Jonathan might disagree with that. But when you have, it seems like individuals should be given some way to challenge a provision. Presumably, when we want people to follow federal law, and if we just have all these federal laws that are presumably unenforceable, you still may have standing to challenge them.
Well, Alan, it's, I mean, the question of what the standing is of the state of Texas and how it's injured. I mean, this was the same issue that, that came up with the DAPA case several years ago, back in the Obama administration, where they had standing because they had to issue licenses to people who got DAPA benefits. This last term in the CELA law case that Elizabeth, I think, mentioned, there was a standing issue there because although the head of the CFPB was duly appointed in accordance with the Appointments Clause, the president could not remove him. And I and others, including Paul Clement, raised the issue as to whether they had the CELA law had standing to object to the president's inability to fire somebody. And the court, Chief Justice Roberts writing, just blew it by, didn't seem to be any difficulty for him at all, and gave it the back of his hand. And so it's hard to know. I mean, I've written something that says you don't have standing unless we want you to have standing. And that's the problem, I think, with standing. I tell my students that it's the worst doctrine. I've written about it, litigated on both sides, testified about it, and I wish it would go away, but it's not going away. And people use it when they want. Justice Ginsburg, for example, used the standing in a couple few years ago in the Virginia Bethune County case, I think it was called, the standing to say that legislatures, the one house of Virginia, couldn't challenge a law changing to redistricting. So, you know, it's where you stand is where you sit on the standing doctrine.
It's sort of like the rules for a stay, right? It's if there are five votes for it. Elizabeth?
Well, I was going to say, Alan took the words out of my mouth. I mean, in the sort of, I guess it's CELA Law 2.0 in the Fannie Freddie case this year,
yes.
You know, the Fifth Circuit opinion, there's a big standing issue. And, you know, one of the ways that they, I think the litigants, and I can't remember exactly the briefing on this, but they tried to posture it is don't worry, because in this particular case, you know, the issue is that the FHFA is the conservator of Fannie and Freddie, is the agency with a constitutional defect. But what they're fighting about in the lawsuit was ultimately subject to the Secretary of Treasury's, you know, approval. And the argument was in this at least unique circumstance, you know, first of all, they were saying you don't have to worry at all about, the, you know, executive branch supervision. The president, you know, supervises the Secretary of Treasury and everything else. And then the standing component on the individual side was that maybe these folks who are, they're Fannie and Freddie shareholders who are suing, they are contesting a deal that the conservator basically struck with the Treasury, arising out of how to pay back certain loans from the financial crisis to the two entities. And the shareholders are saying basically that the, you know, that the conservator did a deal with the devil with the Treasury and allowed it to do sort of a capital stripping campaign that hurt the shareholders. And there's a big question about whether they had, you know, sufficient standing or injury to bring this case at all in the Fifth Circuit. So there's the, you know, to Alan's point, it's like, depending on the facts, you could say, well, don't worry about the constitutional problem. The president was involved in some way. And yeah, these people, maybe they were shareholders and they were injured, but maybe it's not enough in this case to worry about it. Look at the statute. It's a quite complicated case, but I agree with you. I think it's a messy, messy area. And I think they'll have to grapple with it this term as well in that case, if I'm not mistaken.
We have a question from Bill Drabble. Bill, are you there?
I'm here. My question is there any areas where we could expect or at least think that a Justice Barrett would differ from her Republican appointed colleagues? There's a lot of discussion as though she's just going to join in lockstep, which of course never happens. And one justice always has his unique views on the law. So is there any area where we expect Justice Barrett to depart from the other Republican appointees?
Ed, do you want to start?
Sure. Look, I think it's very difficult to say. I mean, I'm sure there will be such areas, but she's been on the Seventh Circuit for 3 years as a federal appellate judge. She and her colleagues are making sense, or trying to make sense of the same Supreme Court opinions, the same circuit precedent as each other. So there really isn't an opportunity to see a whole lot about differences there. Again, she has a, you know, unlike Justice Thomas, she has supported the more traditional approach to stare decisis on constitutional issues, but that doesn't distinguish her from the other seven justices. yeah, I think we have a lot to learn. She has made clear at in the White House Rose Garden ceremony that Justice Scalia's judicial philosophy is hers as well. She's also written that, of course, textualists and originalists operating in good faith don't always arrive at the same answers on questions. So I can't identify any particular areas right now, but I'm, as the questioner indicates, I'm sure there will be some.
I think it's interesting, like Justice Thomas, one of the things that struck me about some of her opinions in the Seventh Circuit, you know, I think she's had some questions about doctrines like qualified immunity for law enforcement, and then she's had some cases, you know, whether it's actually, frankly, her Second Amendment opinion, where she looks to what the point of these restrictions were originally, or I think it was that the bathrobe case. I like to think of it about, you know, who can give consent to an entry. You know, one of the things where you saw, and I always point out, you know, it's interesting, Justice Thomas has crossed, you know, sort of lines on the court is in the Fourth Amendment area, right? I think there was the thermal imaging case where his view was because, you know, originally the government or law enforcement wouldn't be able to look into your house the way the police did in a thermal imaging case, that kind of search was constitutionally impermissible. It ended up being a pro-criminal defendant result based on an application of originalist, you know, sort of jurisprudence. It may be that in some cases, and again, it's impossible to tell, but reading some of her opinions, there may be instances in which her approach to the law would, you know, land her in a place similar to where Justice Thomas is, where he's lining up with maybe an unlikely majority on some of those types of questions.
We have a question from Dan Short. Go ahead, Dan. Hello, you there, Dan? Okay, Anna, is it Saniva?
Sorry about that, muted, it's Saniva, you're correct. So I just wanted to find out if any of you could comment on the case called Torres v. Madrid, because that case is bringing up a lot of important aspects of police use of force. The case is about the excessive use of force. It's a civil case under the Fourth Amendment, and it sounds like or looks like it could potentially have implications for the doctrine of qualified immunity as well. I was wondering if you are aware of any other cases that could have implications on the subject matter, and if you could say anything about this case.
As a matter of fact, I do know someone who can talk about Torres v. Madrid, and that's Orrin Kerr.
Yeah, Torres is a really interesting case. It's going to be argued, I think, October 14th, and it deals with whether it's a seizure for the government to, in this case, shoot someone who keeps driving on. They're in a car, and they're never actually restrained, but they are injured by the shots in this case. And the question is whether that counts as a seizure of the person. And what's really interesting about this case is that usually a seizure means taking control, and this is not. On the other hand, there's a good practical reason to say that this is a seizure, and that if it's a seizure, it then can be included in a Fourth Amendment excessive force claim, which would be, you know, certainly an appeal, you know, a result that you would want from a standpoint of shooting someone counting as excessive force. Seems like a natural thing, whether they happen to stop or not. There's also a really interesting originalist angle to the Torres case, which is a lot of the briefing in the case is about actually the history of what an arrest is. It turns out at common law, it was a tort and also a crime for someone to escape a arrestor's presence. And there was a case law at the time about what exactly an arrest is that triggers this tort of escape. And that was way back in an era where there were no general police officers. Instead, you had like private parties and constables that were in charge of arresting people. They would often want to let them go because it was a big drag to have to bring the prisoner to court. And so it was actually a tort or a crime of the constable to let someone go. And there were cases on what counts as an arrest, and the idea being an arrest is a seizure, that said as long as the constable lays a finger on someone, even if they don't submit to the officer's authority, that is an arrest. And the argument is, does that fit into modern Fourth Amendment law in the same way or not? And very plausibly, it might. You might see kind of a combination of originalist views and practical concerns about the use of excessive force from the left, and you might get kind of a right-left coalition saying that that is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment.
You know, there was a quite a right-left coalition last term that thought that the court would take up this issue and some cases involving qualified immunity, thoughts that it has gone too far, that the court did absolutely nothing with those cases and didn't seem to give much of a reason. Like, maybe we were all wrong that they were actually considering them. What do you think is happening there? Does anyone have a theory?
I'll offer one thought, which is a difficulty with overturning the qualified immunity cases is that what do you replace it with? That then starts this long body of new law that would have to be created of exactly what the standard is and how would the standard apply. There's one thing just to say, there's no qualified immunity ever, period. But then what happens if it was, for example, an officer who conducted a search or seizure that was deemed constitutional at the time and then the law changed? How do you deal with that? Is there some sort of a good faith exception? Do you narrow qualified immunity? Where do you go to? There are a lot of really big choices, and it may be that they're just trying to find a way to take pieces of the puzzle one at a time, or they don't want to take on such a big issue with a single case. That may be why some of the justices are reluctant to jump into this, because the implications are huge. And also, I think, you know, given that Congress in the context of 1983, at least, could just amend Section 1983, maybe they're figuring that it could chew up to Congress. So those are just some guesses.
Because Congress always jumps in to fix the problem.
Yes. And I've written they could do it very simply. They just eliminate it and impose liability on the cities and counties. That's essentially what the law is for the federal government under the Federal Tort Claims Act. And if it's good enough for the federal government, it ought to be good enough for cities and states. This is actually an idea that's been around since the early 1980s. It almost had a chance of being passed back then. But I think Orrin is right that they just don't have the slightest idea how they could tinker with this doctrine to do two things, make it clear and eliminate a lot of the cases and a lot of the problems. So I don't expect the court will do anything on qualified immunity. I think that the chance was there and it didn't take it.
Okay. We have another question from Carly, do I have that correctly?
Can you hear me?
We can.
Hi, thank you so much. My question is in relation to the privileges and immunities, and if you think there's going to be any movement towards reliance on an originalist viewpoint, as in, you know, a lot of Justice Thomas's dissents, if there's any, maybe if there were Justice Barrett, if that he would be able to maybe pull her in on some of that, some of his arguments, which others have declined to follow.
Elizabeth, do you want to start with that, take that?
Sure, sorry, I had to unmute. You know, I think it's a hard but very interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, this gets to a very, you know, sensitive area of the Supreme Court's work. You know, it's an intersection of stare decisis and all of the precedents the court has built up on around the notion of substantive due process and whether the privileges or immunities clause would actually be a more legitimate basis for supporting some of those decisions. So I think what I will say is I don't expect, again, sort of a seismic shift or a rapid, you know, progression there. I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, I'll put it this way, if perhaps there's more attention given to those sorts of arguments going forward if Judge Barrett's confirmed.
I think we have time for one more, and I think Dan Short is back after having some technical problems.
Yes, can you hear me now?
I can.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. And apologies for the issue earlier. I was just curious your perspective going back to the discussion on the ACA case. of how you think about the likelihood of Gorsuch, Alito, or Thomas, and potentially Kavanaugh as well, siding with the other justices on severability, or on another ground, upholding substantively the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, do you want to start us off on that?
Sure. So I think those justices will probably look skeptically at the constitutional issue. So Justice Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Alito, Thomas, potentially the chief, potentially Justice Barrett, I think will be skeptical on the constitutional question. I think the severability question is actually not really an ideological one. Of course, the court's doctrine is simply to ask what Congress would have intended. And this is a complicated case because you have the 2010 statute, and then you have the 2017 amendment that zeroed out the mandate. I think you have Kavanaugh talking in favor last term about narrow severability. You have the chief talking about narrow severability doctrine, and sort of the presumption, even if it's not expressed, that in constitutional questions, you do look to see if the statute can be severable, and the presumption is that it is. So yes, I do think those justices could find the statute to be severable.
Justice Kavanaugh had a decision last term in which he said constitutional litigation is not gotcha legislation for something that Congress may have inadvertently done. Anyone else have something on that? No. All right, well, that is our time. I want to thank you all for participating. If I had some way to show applause, I would do it. But perhaps Lee knows better, so I'm going to turn this back over to her.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks all so much. Thank you very much, Bob. Thanks to all of our speakers. I think there is a way to do it, but I don't know how to do it. There's an icon, but I'm not so Zoom proficient that I know how to do it. But I do want to thank all of you for a very stimulating discussion of the upcoming term, and for very interesting discussion also about the potential impact of Justice Barrett. Thanks so much to all of you for watching, and we hope to see you soon at another Federalist Society event. Check out our webpage at federalistsociety.org for our upcoming events. And with that, thanks to everybody, and have a good afternoon.